giftings that were experienced in the senses in the beginning stage of our spiritual life and were felt, actually felt. Those communications are now being given to the Spirit and taken away from the senses. It is called the food of the strong, and that is infused contemplation in the middle of dryness and darkness in the senses. Now, what's the first benefit? And the benefit caused, in other words, by this dryness and darkness and this contemplation? Well, it's something they know, a humbling knowledge of oneself. If you've had that, it's a good sign. And one's own weakness and misery. When we're in the midst of God's consolations, we're very easily led to think that, you know, we're the greatest. We're on top of everything. And then suddenly they find they're on the bottom of everything. And that's not a good feeling. So the first benefit is a humbling knowledge of oneself, one's own weaknesses, and misery. All the favors God gives the soul now are wrapped up in this kind of self-knowledge, along with the dryness and emptiness experienced in the faculties of the imagination, intellect, a lack of feelings, plus difficulty in practicing virtue. All this makes a person very conscious of his weakness and inadequacy. Before this, a person in this night did not have such knowledge. The insights that now come to such a person are more authentic and trustworthy. Our saint writes, "The soul considers itself to be nothing, finds no satisfaction in self, because it is aware that of itself it neither does nor can do anything." It's a good commentary on, or a realization of what the Lord said, "Without me, you can do nothing." Before this time, the former good deeds that were performed with great satisfaction, great as they might have been, do not please God as much as this person's present lack of self-esteem and dissatisfaction about their serving God so poorly. All those former good works were performed with many imperfections, selfishness, and much ignorance. As a result of this dryness, many other benefits are realized because they come from the healthy self-knowledge that is now given to them. Out of this self-knowledge, we have this amazingly. In that person's communication with God, they now approach God with more respect and courtesy. Before this, there was a want of this kind of courtesy and consideration, and a familiarity with God that was not proper at this time. Second, God grants another kind of enlightenment, namely a knowledge of His grandeur and majesty. With the emptiness and detachment experienced in the senses, appetites, and desires, the intellect is left in such purity and freedom that it grasps revealed truths in greater depth, which a person does not notice when the fog of desires, appetites, feelings cloud the intellect. On the other hand, our saint says, "Anguish, dryness of the senses, illumines and quickens the intellect." Also in the darkness and dryness of contemplation, God supernaturally teaches the detached person about His divine wisdom without hindrance, which He did not do in the days of the beginner stage of sense satisfactions and delights. So it becomes apparent that self-knowledge is the first result of this dry night of sense. And from this self-knowledge comes the knowledge of God. St. Augustine says, "Let me know myself, Lord, and I will know you." Because in philosophy we learn this principle: one extreme is known clearly by the other. The knowledge of self and of God given in this night, while it is very helpful, is nevertheless not as abundant as it will be in the night of the Spirit. But the knowledge now given to the soul is the foundation for that which will be given in the night of the Spirit. Spiritual humility acquired by self-knowledge counteracts the effects of the first capital sin of spiritual pride. Person is now purified of all these imperfections that were so obvious in the beginner stage. Now deeply aware of their own poverty, weakness, faults, sins, the spiritual person does not dare consider himself more advanced than others. Such a thought does not even cross their mind at this time. On the contrary, this privileged soul now realizes that others are better. From this blessed humility comes love of neighbor, because this person now has a real esteem for his neighbor. There's no question of judging his neighbor, which he did so freely in the state of beginners and in first fervor, when he was considered himself better than others because he was able to pray longer, felt better about it. Another blessing is that spiritual person is more willing to be submissive and obedient to those in authority, listens willingly to instructions from others, even wants to be directed and told what to do, no matter who it may be that gives the information. We now notice that presumption on one's own strength, one's own knowledge, ability, is gone. So we see the other imperfections of spiritual pride being removed as one journeys into this night of the senses. And then the vice of avarice is also dealt with. Many imperfections that grew out of the spiritual person's unrestrained desires for spiritual things, seeking sense feeling gratification in a selfish way in one's prayers, spiritual exercises, all these are purified. Because of the dryness felt in these same spiritual exercises, the want of satisfaction in them, this person performs these exercises with great moderation, so much so that there may be a danger of not performing them with any zeal at all. But God usually grants souls in this state the humility and willingness to perform all their duties for love of Him alone. Without knowing it, the soul becomes detached from many things simply through this constant dryness. And in spiritual lust, again, due to the constant dryness of the senses and dislike to perform spiritual exercises, the soul is freed from the imperfections we mentioned earlier about feelings of lust. These feelings ordinarily come from the pleasure the senses take in the delights given to the spirit. And spiritual gluttony. We mentioned the imperfections of spiritual gluttony, for example, the great craving for sense consolations in spiritual things, especially prayer. These are reformed. In this night, the spirit is freed from these and many other imperfections that we haven't even mentioned. God now restrains the desires and appetites of a person in this night that he's unable to find any sense delight in any things of earth or of heaven. This is continued until these desires and appetites are brought into submission, restrained and reformed. As a result, the passions lose their strength and vitality because they are unfulfilled. Once this is accomplished, admirable blessings follow. Spirit now dwells in what may be called a spiritual peace and tranquility. Here, the spiritual person enjoys God's peace and consolations. A second benefit from the above blessing, there follows a constant remembrance of God, accompanied by a fear and great concern that one might turn back on this spiritual journey. This fear is not a restless fear. It's a holy fear. This is a great blessing. Before this particular person had no such concern because of the dullness and the blindness induced by many attachments, appetites, and desires. A third benefit. In this night, the soul practices all the virtues together. Patience, perseverance, in spite of the dryness and emptiness in the senses, they continue to pray, continue to do their spiritual tasks. They're faithful to their spiritual exercises with an unselfish love of God, because there is no longer any personal satisfaction in these good works. The virtue of fortitude, the courage and strength that is present in a hidden way through the very weakness that the person experiences in their dislike for good works, and yet they do them. Our saint adds, finally, in these aridities, dryness, the soul practices corporally and spiritually all the virtues, theological as well as cardinal and moral virtues, namely faith, hope, love, prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. Now, these four benefits of the night of the sense, the pleasure of peace, habitual remembrance of God, and constant concern about Him, a sense of cleanness and purity of soul, and fourth, the practice of virtue. Now, many in this state don't realize that. They have to be assured. Then the vice of anger. The spirit is softened and humbled by the constant dryness, temptations, and trials that God permits. In consequence, there is an evident meekness, gentleness toward God, oneself, and one's neighbor. We seldom see this person become impatient and angry with themselves over their faults or with brothers and sisters in the Lord. Nor do we see that peevishness and discourteous attitude toward God because God has not made them perfect in 7 days. The vice of envy. Now, when this spiritual person observes the goodness and virtues of others, he's not grief-stricken and distressed because they are better and more advanced. Rather, he's charitable toward them. If there's any envy, it's a holy envy. In other words, he wants to imitate the good he sees in others, and he praises God for the good that he sees in others. This is a sign of solid virtue. And finally, sloth. The weariness a person feels in his exercises is not the vice of sloth. What sloth was really present before this time was due to the spiritual satisfaction that person enjoyed or sought to enjoy when it was not present. So the weariness now experienced does not come from sense satisfaction present in the beginner stage, because now God removes satisfaction as he purifies the appetites. And there are innumerable other benefits besides the ones we've mentioned that come from this dry contemplation. It's another word for the dark night, dry contemplation. God knows how to temper the times of dryness and trial with frequent communications to the soul when at least expects it. At times he bestows spiritual sweetness or a very pure love and spiritual knowledge that is very delicate. These blessings are of more worth than all that the soul desired before this time. But in the beginning of this night, this person will not think so, because spiritual communications are very subtle and not apparent to the senses. Finally, freed of attachment to sense affections and appetites, the soul acquires liberty of spirit, in which freedom he acquires the fruits of the Holy Spirit: love, joy, peace, goodness, kindness, gentleness, patience, long-suffering, self-control. Moreover, the spiritual person is wonderfully free from his three enemies: the world, the flesh, the devil. When the delights and pleasures of the sense nature are dried up, neither the devil, the world, nor the flesh has power over the spirit. So this blessed dryness makes a person travel with a detached, unselfish love for God. Now he's not motivated to good works by the pleasure and satisfaction that he personally finds in them, but by the desire simply to please God. We do not see a person who is presumptuous or self-satisfied. Instead, there's a holy fear that stands as guard over one's virtues and increases them. The dryness also dries up the natural passions and appetites in their unrestrained vigor. And during this desert dryness and night, the soul's concern for God and desires to serve Him increase. This is very pleasing to God because it is a disguised way, unknown to that person, of showing that they really love God. God sees it, but they don't. Knowing all this, once the soul has passed through the night of sense, the line of the stanza we are dealing with is no exaggeration. All the sheer grace, I went out unseen. In other words, I went on my spiritual way, no longer subject or a slave to my sense appetites and desires. I traveled unseen, hidden from my three enemies, world, flesh, and the devil, who were unable to stop me and keep me back from freely attaining the freedom of God's love. Their weapons against me, my own unrestrained appetites, desires, and passions, and feelings, were purified and moderated in this dark night. That's the comment on that line. The four passions, joy, sorrow, hope, and fear, have now been calmed, moderated, through constant mortification. Also, the sense appetites have been, as it were, put to sleep. And an inner harmony has been reached in the interior senses, the imagination, memory, reasoning mind, through a disuse of the prayer of meditation involving these faculties. These too are quieted and subject to the Spirit. Now this person can say what we have in our next line, my house being now all stilled. When the senses have been mortified, the passions moderated, appetites calmed, the soul sets out on what may be called a journey on the road of the Spirit, which is the advanced stage of the spiritual life, and St. John has several names for it, and he calls it the illuminative way, or the way of proficience, or the way of infused contemplation. On this path, God Himself feeds, refreshes the Spirit, without any mental work of any kind on the part of the soul. By any kind, I do not exclude the will. The will is, I should say, involved, but very simply, in an act of surrender. What we've said above so far describes the ordinary experience of the night of the senses. If God intends to bring such a person into the night of the Spirit, to the perfection of the union of love with God, then the night of the senses take on more burdensome trials and temptations through the senses that last a fairly long time, longer in some than in others, depending on their former sinfulness and the degree of holiness to which God calls the individual. Our Carmelite says that the spirit of fornication is sometimes allowed to afflict a person's senses with strong and disgusting temptations, to harass the spirit with dreadful thoughts and disturbing vivid images that sometimes produce pain worse than death. On other occasions, during this night of the senses, the spirit of blasphemy is allowed to insinuate terrible blasphemies against the person's, into the person's thoughts. St. John says the blasphemies carry such strong suggestion to the imagination that a person is almost forced to express them in words, and this is a source of great agony of conscience to the soul. That addition, agony of conscience, indicates that they have good will, that it was forced out of them. There may be another spirit called to disturb the soul, and is called the spirit of confusion. Remember, this spirit is not sent to cause the downfall of the soul, but to test it. So the senses are so darkened that they are filled with 1,000 scruples, doubts, and insolvable conflicts. It seems to the person that these problems can never be resolved. No one seems to be able to give them the support of wise advice at this time, at least to their satisfaction. According to our Carmelite master, this trial is one of the most terrible afflictions of this night of sense, and is similar to what happens in the night of the spirit. As was mentioned above, God permits such storms and trials to come to a person in this night when he plans to lead them later on into the night of the spirit. Not all souls go on to the night of the spirit. Remember that if a person is not tempted, tried, and purified by temptations, trials, the senses will not be sufficiently strengthened and submissive to the spirit for the wisdom that will be given to the soul. By all these trials, the human spirit is humbled, purified, detached, so that it can be blessed and exalted in the transforming union. No one can say how long a person will be kept in this night of the senses. Not everyone suffers the same kind of night, nor are the temptations the same. This is determined by God's will, by the greater or lesser imperfection and sinfulness of the person to be purified. If God wishes to raise a person to a very high degree of love for him, he humbles and tests it with a greater or lesser intensity and for a longer or shorter length of time. Those who have a strong character, who have a greater capacity and ability to endure suffering, are purified more intensely and quickly. But individuals who are very weak, God keeps in the night of the senses for a long time, because their purification is less intense and their temptations are moderated. Also, God frequently refreshes their senses to keep them from giving up their struggles. Such souls arrive at the state of perfection late in life. Some of these individuals never reach this perfection entirely because they are never quite into the night of the senses, nor entirely out of it. While they do not advance further, God tries them for short periods and different times in a variety of temptations and dryness to keep them humble and to give them that true self-knowledge that's so important for all who are to live in God's company. At other times, the Lord grants them consolation so they do not lose courage and remain faithful in striving to grow in holiness. With other weaker individuals, God grants them consoling manifestations of his presence, then hides himself. He does this to make them grow in love, because they would never grow out of their selfish love of him without the experience of these absences of the Lord. And our saint ends this book one by saying, as is evident through experience, souls will pass on to so happy and lofty a state as is the union of love, they must usually remain in these drynesses and temptations for a long time, no matter how quickly God leads them. But our saint does not set any exact time, because he doesn't know, nor does anyone else know, how long God will do this. Only God knows that. So, what are some of the temptations? What are the trials? Well, very likely, all of you have been through some of them already. They are what makes up life. In other words, an illness, a personal illness, a family trial that afflicts the whole family, a financial loss, a loss of good name, slander, people talk about you, a loss of friendship, disappointments, misunderstandings, all kinds of personal relationships that become emotionally upset. In other words, it's the nitty-gritty of your daily life. Only at that time, it's piled on. It's not, in other words, isolated. A number of things happen at the same time, and there's no let-up. And then within a person, there's that dryness. Or things may be fine outside, but inside, you know, Death Valley. Nobody knows how you feel if you're able to wear a smile. But inside, you know, it's the Sahara Desert. When you pray, nothing. Nobody up there. Nobody listening. It's gone to lunch. So the inclination there is, you know, to cut down on the prayers. It was very likely during such a period that St. Teresa of Avila, in those days, didn't have a wristwatch, you know. What they had was a sand glass with a curve this way and a very small neck and then another curve down below. So the sand trickled through and it was gauged for several hours. So Teresa had that beside her when she was praying. When the hour got too long, she'd shake it. So if she shook her sand watch, you can't be blamed for looking at your watch once in a while. So there are then, you know, you can be tempted against any one of the virtues. And as we mentioned, when St. John talks about the spirit, he's talking about an evil spirit. See? He's not saying it's just an attack through your own weakness, but he's saying the Lord allows a spirit of fornication, a spirit of confusion, a spirit of doubt, a spirit of scruple to test this person. And then it's like being put through the ringer. And nobody seems to be able to help them. And at that time is oftentimes when they make heroic prayers. It may have been at such a time, but not, I would say, in the senses, but for St. Francis de Sales in the Night of the Spirit, when he was given a trial where he thought he was damned. He was thinking about the theology of predestination. In other words, does God predestine souls to be damned? And so he was struggling with that. And he could come up with no answer that would satisfy him. He was so depressed by the thought that he would be damned. And if he was damned, what about all the good works that he did? It didn't avail him any in any way. That'd be enough to depress anybody. And so as he struggled with that, he saw no escape from it. And his whole spirit was in a terrible agony, almost like hell itself. And he ended up with a heroic prayer that finally relieved him of this. And that was, Lord, if I'm going to be damned to hell, then I accept it on one condition, that I can love you there. And that cloud lifted. But see, God sometimes forces a person into a heroic act of prayer, which they could never say by themselves. Having said it, he just blesses them with all kinds of graces. So we see that in the life of St. Teresa and Little Flower too. So we'd be inclined to say, God is cruel. No. We always have to keep in mind that the Lord does say, my ways are not your ways. And we can never characterize anything he does as lacking in love, because he is love. But his way of loving is not our way. See, it draws the best out of us. And only because, if he does test us, is because he wants to give us so much. Because he loves us so much. But we're not ready for it. So we have to be washed out. Well, any questions?
Father, is there any truth to that predestination?
No.
Thank God.
The Calvinists were moved into that era by John Calvin. They're known today as the, I believe, the Presbyterians. Formerly in history, they were called the Huguenots. I'm not sure that they believe that today either, but it was a very dismal thing, you know, a very terrible image of God, namely that God created some people to be damned and others to go to heaven. And they had ways of determining who were damned. You know, anybody was against them. And But that is enough to depress anybody. I mean, all the good works that you do, all the prayers that you say, they're of no good. If you want any error to promote crime, that's it. Just convince somebody that he's damned. So he goes out and has a good time. He doesn't care who he kills and whatever. There's a consequence of that is just horrible. So God does not predestine a person to be damned. The answer to the word predestination, we've done that this weekend in Ephesians, on God has predestined. That term applies to God's people as a people, not to any one individual. God predestined his people to be saved. Now, who will be saved will be determined on that person's use of his free will. In other words, the choices that person makes in life will determine whether that person will be saved or damned. God doesn't damn them. They do themselves. That free will is so free that God will not interfere with a choice when he knows that it will damn that person. But he will give them all the needs, all the helps they need to save themselves and more, because he wants to save them. But in the end, it's how that person uses God's grace or abuses it or refuses to use it. So predestination in that sense is not to say that God destined some people for hell even before they're created. That's terrible.
Doesn't St. Paul say something about that in relation to Judas?
No, the Lord said. The text is put, it's better for that man if he were not born.
No, there's some sort of discussion or whatever. I thought that's what you were referring one of the letters about, that Judas more or less had his lot prepared for him, just the way Christ did.
No. Why would the Lord select Judas as one of the apostles? He gave him every opportunity. That has nothing to do with predestination. God knows, however, who will be lost. But that does not influence the good that he does to everyone to bring them to salvation. But yes, he has infinite knowledge. He knows all the choices a person will make. But it does not influence him to deny a person that will be lost that he knows the graces that they will need to be saved. See, God is infinitely merciful. That kind of understanding conflicts with what the God we read about in the revealed word. God so loved the world as to give his only begotten Son. That's for each one of us. You can't square that with God damning anybody, even before they could work out their salvation. Yes, Rick? All right. Debbie? Louder.
Mary of Fatima said to the children that she showed them hell where many sinners go, and said, many sinners go to hell because no one can pray for them. Now, if God is giving them enough grace, why do we have to pray for these sinners that they will embrace?
Who are we to tell God what to do? He gives them through our prayers. He gives them through the sacrifices of other people.
Oh, okay.
And he gives them simply because he wants to. Because he's good.
He knew we were going to pray for them.
Pardon?
It's kind of like he knew from all the time we were going to pray for these people.
Yeah. That's how he works out the salvation of, for example, you know the families that have black sheep, and they come back to the church. Well, how did that happen? The family was praying for them. Right? And eventually they got enough grace, you know, just zapped them. Like Monica praying for Augustine. 30 years. Boy, that was quite an anvil when it hit Augustine.
That was a big run away from the dream. I was first, I read along with Lionel. signs of the spiritual life was that I am where I am because somebody was praying for me, and I was so grateful. And I wanted to make sacrifices for others, pray and sacrifice for me.
Well, that's a very comforting thought to know that, you know, others are praying for you. And you remember Paul talks about that too, intercession. He often mentions that to the different people that he wrote to, the Ephesians, where he says, I praise and thank God for you and lift you up in prayer. And he asks them to pray for him. And of course, that's behind the communion of saints, the doctrine of the communion of saints. See, they're there to pray for us, and we get the response, how do you think saints are canonized? Because people pray for miracles through them, and they get them. And they're not just, you know, miracles that are not, cannot be accepted because they're faith miracles. These are first-class miracles that the medical world cannot explain, that have to be instantaneous cures, so clear that nobody doubts. And when you get a miracle like that, you can only say, that's outside the realm of man. This has to be a supernatural event, and only God could do that, through the intercession of this saint. So you have then a, what you call a proof for the power of intercession, the power of prayer. And God uses that. But he most of all uses suffering offered up with prayer. That is powerful. Yes?
I was just going to say, you know, like you said something today that struck me. You said, at the beginning of the Mass, I hope you see the agony and suffering. And I was thinking of one person in my life, my daughter. Now, she's not a bad child. She's not into anything bad. She has a very high-strung, strong, stubborn nature that no matter what we do or say, she always takes the opposite. I really feel like for this child, the suffering that I have with this child, I'm acquiring all this patience. I'm acquiring all this patience, which goes on to almost all the other attitudes I have about life. I've been trying to, I believe mothers, it's kind of like a thermometer, dark night. Mothers, the things mothers suffer with, it could be babyhood, teenagers, or even adults, when you have adult children, won't we suffer? And they take wrong choices or things that we think are wrong, and yet the Lord always brings them back.
Right. What you're describing there are only conditions of the dark night for a woman who is a mother. See, out of any one of our circumstances, where we're at, God creates the dark night. It might be a person who might be an office worker, like this young girl I'm telling you about, the secretary, the boss was nasty to her. But she got back at the boss with a coffee. She gave him blessed coffee. Well, Sanka never thought it would be blessed. But the Lord is a master at using all the events of our life, you see, for our good. Another proof. All things work unto good, right?
Yes.
A nasty boss, you know, a nasty husband, or a nasty wife, or whatever. See, there isn't one incident in our life that the Lord can't, you know, use for our good. Bad weather? Yes?
The lady is right, because I have a son, oh my God. I don't know where I got it from or what. If I had my second son of friends, I don't think I would have had it. But he said to me one time, I seem to be a thorn in his side, Mark, and you said it. First he gets married, and it's all this, and he has a child, and he loses a child, and he has another one, and the marriage, but it's been one thing after another with this one son, and I love him dearly, but he was in the death of me yet.
Well,
I'm just praying that he was trying to. Well,
isn't it true? What you're saying there is another good reason for God only wants us to know one day at a time. If we knew what was coming, we'd be afraid to take another step. But when you talk about suffering, see, we again should really enter into the sufferings of the Lord. And one element of his suffering is, how would you feel if you knew that tomorrow at 12 o'clock noon you were going to break your right leg? Now, you've got the knowledge and you're waiting for that to happen. You think you can sleep on that? And when it comes around 11 o'clock and you're waiting for this to happen, you'll probably die of anxiety. Now, apply that to the Lord. He knew everything that was going to happen. And he carried that in his heart, and especially in Gethsemane. He knew everything that was going to happen. Okay? Now, there's a suffering that we never think of. So when you've got anxieties, you can go to the Lord. He understands.
John? You know, getting back to what this lady was saying about her son and like St. Monica and St. Augustine, could you say that whatever, like St. Augustine or these children that go astray, could that be a purification for them? Could that be like a dark night of the senses?
For the children or for the parents?
For the children.
Certainly for the parents.
Yeah, I know. But could it be for the children and that they're getting purified? I mean, like...
No, not as long as they're in a state of sin. It's not a purification. The humbling knowledge of that later on, yes, and that experience, even out of sin, God will draw good. In other words, the humbling knowledge of their weakness. Okay?
When they come to that realization, and then, because sin sometimes, to me, could be a suffering, too. I mean, I don't really, you know, like when people are doing all these bad things, I think they're really suffering in a way. You know, themselves. I mean, like, it's almost going against their nature to be doing things like that. You know, especially, say, if they came from a good family or something like that and have a pretty good background. And I'm wondering if this could be like a purification where they really hit rock bottom and they come to the realization that...
It's not a purifying thing spiritually for them. Sin never is that in that sense. No. See, it is an offense.
Yeah.
But forgiven, and then the humbling knowledge... The contrition, that's the sorrow for what they've done, that's purifying.
Yeah.
And then the experience of their weakness and the remembrance of that in view of God's goodness. When God brings a soul to high perfection, one of the things that really makes them suffer most was how God killed them literally with kindness.
It
just overwhelms them with kindness. And that thought, you know, just is too much for them.
He's saying that he gives us an up rope till we hang ourselves, and in some cases...
No, that's a bad way to put it. That makes the Lord look like a Gestapo agent.
No, I'm saying that we have that free will to choose that, but he lets us have the rope until we hang ourselves, again and again and again, until we see that we cannot do really, we cannot survive without him.
Well,
so
I would...
then he allows us, since we don't come to him willingly, but we come to him sometimes through disaster.
Okay, but I wouldn't say hang himself.
Ourselves.
That's too final. But he allows a person to hit rock bottom, yes.
Well, same. I said it again and again and again, so that, how many times could you hang yourself, you know?
Well, I still don't, I object to hanging. Just a moment. Anyone else have a question? Yes, Tom.
Could you explain something about this page 328, this area of spirit of blasphemy and also fornication and also this area of
Well, an absolute trust in the Lord. Go to a spiritual director. Seek the prayer support of others in whom they can trust. and then just to stay there with the Lord. No, not as long as the Lord permits. Take the example of St. Catherine of Siena. This is where it's good to know the lives of the saints. One day, she had this spirit of fornication. In other words, all kinds of horrible, unchaste thoughts came to her mind. It looked like it was hell itself. You know, there's no way, no holy thought or anything had supported her. And yet she dreaded it. I mean, it was like being clothed with dead flesh. It just made her skin crawl. And it was just awful. All day long, she was resisting it, saying no. And finally, at the end of the day, she went to the Lord and she said, "Lord, where were you all this time?" And he said, "Catherine, I was in the center of your heart." Because as long as she said no, it didn't mean a thing. Didn't hurt her at all. In fact, she grew, you know, by leaps and bounds. Again, the temptation was only an invitation, which he was rejecting all day long. And the same thing about anything else, any other vice. So, what did she do? She resisted. And what can anyone else do? Keep saying no. Keep reaffirming their commitment to the Lord. Or saying that prayer that I've given you. Jesus, be my holiness. Whatever virtue you're tempted against.
My grandmother was charismatic, you know, and she'd pray in tongues. And then every so often she'd spit. And that, I believe, was the time when the devil...